That's Ray Barretto with Power. That's the name of the tune. But it's also the title track of his 1970 album, Barretto Power. Ray Barretto was born in New York City, raised in Spanish Harlem, and was known not only for his music, but his unrelenting pride in his Puerto Rican culture and identity. When he died in 2006 at the age of 76, his body was flown to Puerto Rico, where honors were given by the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture. He would have loved that, and I'm sure he did. Ray Barretto basically traversed the full gamut of music styles. And, of course, he was most well-known for not only being a composer, but also for his percussion talents on congas especially. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, July the 8th, 2015. And we'll be talking about bleeding to debt, as with Detroit, so with Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is in a death spiral, says Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla. He says it's unable to pay an estimated $72 billion in debt. Padilla's plea to creditors for concessions and more time on overdue notes isn't playing well with bondholders. And Puerto Ricans have had it with government cutbacks and runaway increases in the cost of living in order to service the debt. Padilla sees a way out, and that way out is declaring bankruptcy. But there is a problem. By law, only U.S. municipalities and states can seek bankruptcy protection from the courts, and Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, not a state, and so it must first seek special dispensation from Congress, and there is a rising battle about that. Padilla has hired former federal judge Stephen Rhodes as a consultant on restructuring Puerto Rico's debt. For many, it's a troubling sign because, you see, Judge Rhodes, who's now in private practice, was the same judge who presided over Detroit's contentious $18 billion bankruptcy that sanctioned wholesale plunder of the once prosperous city in order to settle that debt. Our guest is a familiar voice. It's that of Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire and has been our correspondent on all things Detroit, especially through the bankruptcy proceedings, all 18 months of it. He covered and educated us about it, what was going on in Detroit, and since then. But he joins us today to discuss the parallels between Detroit and the situation in Puerto Rico. Remember, when we were discussing this, I said that the bankruptcy, the forced bankruptcy of Detroit, and we covered that at length, explaining the structure, the system to you, we said that it was to serve as a template for other bankruptcies to come. Here we are, an entire nation is now poised to follow the Detroit bankruptcy model. Thanks, Abayomi, for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, obviously, this resonates with you at a very deep level because you clearly see the parallels here between Detroit and the situation now confronted by Puerto Rico. Could you explain how that is with you, how it sits with you?
Yes. First of all, last year, during the summer of 2014, we had had some dialogue with some activists dealing with Puerto Rican issues, both on the islands and as well as here in the United States. And it was quite interesting because as early as a year ago or more, there was discussion, you know, about the imposition of draconian austerity measures in Puerto Rico. And in Detroit, we've been undergoing the same process for at least 5 to 7 years. So this is nothing that is alien to us here in the city of Detroit. And what's also striking is that for many, many, many years, well over a century, Puerto Rico has had an independence movement. And those who support that movement say that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States because they were taken over from Spain during the turn of the 19th and 20th century. There's also a theory that major urban areas in the United States that are occupied by large numbers of African Americans and other peoples of color are also internal colonies. So there's a striking similarity in that regard as well. So I think that the people in Puerto Rico are going to experience even deeper levels of domination by the United States, particularly international finance capital that's based in New York City on Wall Street. And now they're trying to figure out a methodology for the imposition of a bankruptcy or restructuring process in Puerto Rico. It was the same situation here 2 years ago.
Well, let's walk through that a bit, because we need to understand the significance of Governor Padilla retaining the services of Judge Rhodes. What does this mean to you? What does this signal?
Well, it signals that the people are in for huge attacks on public ownership, on whatever gains that have been made by the Puerto Rican people in the areas of labor, civil service, civil society in general. That indicates to us here in the city of Detroit. And the governor should be mindful of the fact that we had, of course, advocated a moratorium on payments to these financial institutions because they were considered illegitimate. Now, I've read, even in the Associated Press over the last week, that Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla has said that the overall debt is unpayable as far as Puerto Rico is concerned, and that he will seek a moratorium on payments. So this is also a very interesting development as well. But whatever the Commonwealth government will attempt to do there, they're going to have to have the support of the Puerto Rican people. That is going to be key in this whole process. And if they could divide the people, as they attempted to do in Detroit, and to a certain degree they were able to do it, that's going to be a major hurdle in working out any type of agreement with these international bankers. We see also the same situation in Greece as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's return here to the specifics of Judge Rhodes' role in the bankruptcy and the approval of the exit plan, the exit strategy that the imposed city manager had come up with, and what it caused in the way of impact to Detroiters. Could you tell us what came out at the end of that tunnel, that long tunnel to resolving its $18 billion debt? Who got what? And what did Judge Rhodes okay?
He okayed the expropriation of anywhere between $6.5 billion and $7 billion in retirement funds for City of Detroit pensioners, involving their health care programs, as well as cuts in their monthly pension checks, as well as a so-called repayment of overpaid annuities. So this is what came out of it. Also, there was a endorsement of widespread disinvestment of public assets from the City of Detroit. For example, Belle Isle, one of the largest, if not the largest, public parks in the United States, was turned over to the state, and now it is a state facility that's patrolled by the Michigan State Police. And you have to have a pass, essentially, from the Secretary of State's office to enter Belle Isle now. It used to be a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week facility for the people of the City of Detroit and the state of Michigan. Then there was the privatization of the Detroit Public Works, wiping out jobs as well as other benefits. There was, of course, the regionalization of the water, which is a major issue that is still quite controversial right now, because we are sitting on perhaps one of the largest concentrated sources of fresh water in the world. And there was no reason for the City of Detroit's water system to be regionalized other than to disempower the people in the City of Detroit. We've also seen attacks on public lighting. Despite the propaganda that you see in the local Detroit newspaper.
Oh, we lost him there for a minute. Let's try to get him back. We're hoping to get him back very shortly. These things happen. He's out in the field, and sometimes the service out in the field is quite erratic. So we'll work on getting him back. The forced bankruptcy, because we, as we have discovered and discussed on this program, Detroit was forced into bankruptcy. And then came the divvying of the spoils. It's not to say that Detroit did not have debts, but Tom Barrow, as you may recall, who was a former, who had headed up, in fact, the state's agency for accrediting accountants, had said that there was nothing there at the time of Detroit's debt that suggested that Detroit could not pay its debt or collateralize its debt. But the bankruptcy was in fact forced upon Detroit. The governor forced an emergency manager who essentially overruled all democratic processes in Detroit, literally was calling the shots as opposed to the elected officials of Detroit. They had no say at all, and they were not in control of the city. Draconian measures were implemented that drove a spike into the heart of already suffering people in the city of Detroit. And in the end, the exit plan, as it was called, the exit strategy for Detroit out of bankruptcy, involved wholesale looting, essentially, of its assets, the banks and other financial institutions and politically well-connected entities were able to put their hands on land and on other assets of the city of Detroit for a very long time. So when Puerto Rico announced, the governor of Puerto Rico announced just last week that the debt that it has is not payable, and when the governor retained the services of the same judge who oversaw the bankruptcy process and gave it a green light in Detroit, it certainly did raise some questions, and it clearly signaled, at least to me, a striking parallel between the bankruptcy proceedings in Detroit and what is probably going to happen in Puerto Rico if people don't oppose it. And I'm sure there's vigorous opposition to it. This is the first conversation we're having about the situation in Detroit, but I mean in Puerto Rico, but we will come back to it again. I'm just starting out by showing you through our discussion with Abayomi Ezekwe that we are seeing the parallels. How it is that when systems are developed, no matter where they are applied, they are put into effect in order to yield the same result. We have Abayomi back with us. Thanks again. Yes. You're there, right?
Yeah, I'm here. I just couldn't hear your voice for some reason.
Got cut off. You probably are in the field and the signals are quite erratic. But I'm glad you're back with us. But let's proceed with this parallel, because this is really significant. Because as went Detroit, so probably will go Puerto Rico, unless there is a major, major opposition going here. But we see already that at least in the mind of the governor, and certainly in the mind of Judge Rhodes, who is now in private practice as a consultant, we see the positioning of Puerto Rico in the same way that Detroit was positioned, to present to creditors a series of really nice little deals that they could make and to compensate for the inconvenience of not being paid on time. And that is to put their hands on major assets in Puerto Rico and to come away actually far better off than they would have had they gone through the made concessions and given Puerto Rico more time to deal with its debt restructuring.
Yes. What's quite interesting about this is that they have to change the laws governing the relations between Puerto Rico and the United States in order to carry out a bankruptcy in the same fashion that they did in the city of Detroit. And what's happening in Detroit is it's a continuation of the same process. But it's quite also striking that the people who have analyzed the situation in Puerto Rico have said that it would be, if it was an independent state, it would be the eighth most heavily indebted country in the world. I mean, that's almost astonishing, considering the size, you know, of Puerto Rico and also its long-term relationship with the United States, and that the island does not obtain, if they don't obtain the right to declare bankruptcy, it will either restructure the debt or go into default. So what does that really mean in terms of going into default? While I've outlined what has happened in Detroit, you know, with the expropriation of public assets, the theft of over $6 billion in pension funds, and also the overall disempowerment of people even further than what already exists. So that is the main challenge facing Puerto Rico right now. But I think it's indicative of what's going on internationally in terms of the instability of the world economic system as we see it. Now, I think Greece is not isolated in Europe, that there are other countries there. They're utilizing Greece as a model for imposing permanent austerity on the majority of people in these population groups.
You mentioned the fact that, like Detroit, Puerto Rico will have to undergo a dramatic constitutional change, and it may very well be imposed. Could you talk a bit about that? What was the change that happened in Detroit, and what is the change that is likely to happen in terms of constitutional and legal changes? What is the change that is likely to come to Puerto Rico as it deals with its $72 billion debt?
I'm glad you asked that question, because this is central to the whole discussion around this. In Detroit and in the state of Michigan, there was, by the rule of the Constitution, you could not impair pensions in the state. Also, according to the state constitution, only the mayor or the city council or a combination of the two could apply for bankruptcy for a municipality. So these are two key areas that they changed by, with the utilization of a emergency manager, which filed for bankruptcy, and also utilizing the federal courts, i.e. Judge Stephen Rhodes, who said that the pensions could be impaired in an economic crisis involving a municipality. He said this in his eligibility ruling in late 2013, saying that the city of Detroit was eligible for bankruptcy because, in effect, it wasn't. I mean, no pension payments had been missed. There were no payless paydays. They contrived this crisis, even though the city was being bled and had been bled by the banks and the corporations for decades. They exacerbated the crisis. They withheld funds in order to restructure and to turn over billions and billions of dollars to banks, turn over land to bond-holding corporations, and to also create a situation where for years to come, the people in the city of Detroit would not fully be in control of their own futures and their own economic policies in particular.
And this had a multi-tiered effect, because we had the governor basically usurping the authority of the duly elected officials of the city by imposing an emergency manager, and that emergency manager basically deriving extraordinary powers, wide-ranging power to do whatever he felt was necessary to do, again, superseding the power of elected people whose job it was to run the city. He was, in fact, this one person was running the show with governmental sanction. How is it likely to operate in Puerto Rico? Did we lose him again? Yes, we did. I'm so sorry about that, but we will muddle through. This is part of what we do. Sometimes things don't go the way they are planned, because we get things that are out of our control. So we'll continue to try and reestablish connection with Abayomi Ezekwe. But again, this is a major, major problem. So Abayomi, you back again?
Yes.
We're having some problems, but we'll deal with them as we go.
Right.
I was talking about the imposition of an unelected, unconstitutionally elected person basically having entire control of a city and with the sanction of the governor under so-called emergency management law. How is it likely to happen in Puerto Rico?
Well, what they did in the state of Michigan and in the city of Detroit in particular, there was opposition to the imposition of the emergency management system to revise that system. It already existed, but they wanted to enhance it where you would totally take away any concept or notion of local control. So what they did, the people in the city of Detroit embarked upon a petition campaign. They collected hundreds of thousands of petitions to have this put on the ballot. There was an attempt to block it. It went all the way to the state Supreme Court, and they had to agree to an election. And overwhelmingly, not just the people of Detroit, but throughout the state of Michigan, people voted against the emergency manager law. You know, this is what has been lost in the whole narrative about Detroit and about the state of Michigan. So what they did during a lame duck session, they went and rewrote the law again and imposed it anyway and tacked it on to a appropriations bill, which is almost referendum proof. So they exercise complete dictatorial and undemocratic methods to impose emergency management and consequently bankruptcy on the city of Detroit. So in order to do this, they have to nullify any notion of even bourgeois constitutional rights that states had in the United States. And the federal government went right along with the whole process. They would not intervene. The Justice Department, the White House, the U.S. Congress, none of them said a word about what happened in Detroit.
Well, $72 billion may sound like a major tragedy in terms of debt, but to some places, this is just wonderful. This is a great, great opportunity here to make some money. Could you talk about what you think is happening with bondholders on Wall Street, the people who basically own this debt? What are they getting ready to do based on the experience that you had in Detroit covering the Detroit bankruptcy? What is happening now?
Well, they realize this, the system is unsustainable, so they have to restructure the perpetual payment to the international financial institutions and give it a cloak of legality. And that is what they have done in the city of Detroit. They've done it in other cities throughout the state of Michigan and other cities throughout the United States. In Illinois, they have already established that they have to do something about what they call legacy cost, which is the obligations of municipalities as well as state governments to pensioners, to civil servants, to public ownership of resources and so forth. So we'll see even more of this in Puerto Rico. And unless there's a massive campaign by the people in Puerto Rico against this plan for the imposition of austerity. But it shows that the international banking system is in deep crisis, and that is really the lesson of all of this, that the way things have gone for decades, where the banks and these bond-holding agencies are allowed essentially to get away with murder, that there is no future in this whole process. And I think that's what the people in Greece are saying through their referendum. And it would be great if the people in Puerto Rico could have a referendum as well on this whole process.
Well, that's to be hoped for, but it may not happen because
no.
the deck is kind of stacked against them.
Yes.
Even the governor seems to be going along with the program. Padilla is, I'm sure by now, he's put together a series of austerity measures in order to impress the creditors that he really, really wants to get through this crisis, and he's willing to play ball. So I imagine that very shortly, on the one side, we have the creditors putting their teams together to figure out what can be had, and how they can make this crisis really pay off. And on the side of the governor, basically what he has to do to impress the creditors and whichever overarching entities will be overseeing this bankruptcy, that Puerto Rico, under his stewardship, because this is a political question, will come out of its onerous debt, but it will take a little bit more sacrificing. So his job is to put together something that he can sell. And, of course, he will be, perhaps that's why Rhodes is there, to be the liaison between the two, to bring all the parties together on the same at the same table so that they can kind of work things out independently of the people's demands.
Yes, and the notion or the cloak of legitimacy, you know, there was months and months of hearings in Detroit. As I've conveyed to you, you know, over the last 2 years, over 600 people filed legal objections to the bankruptcy in Detroit, and all of that essentially was ignored. I mean, there were. Now, I don't want to minimize the struggle that was waged against the bankruptcy. In fact, if there had been no opposition, it would have been a lot worse. They initially started out talking about 84% in pension cuts, or either a total elimination of public pensions in Detroit. That hasn't happened as of yet, but at the same time, the fact that they were able to take what they have taken is a demonstration that there has to be a massive effort on the part of the people to fight these people and to beat them back. And what the tragedy of it is, because of the global capitalist system, Puerto Rico utilizes the United States dollar as its medium of currency. Greece uses the euro largely as its currency of choice. So this is the problem. So what they do, they withdraw their funds, you know, from your banks or the banks that are based in your area, and then at the same time they threaten that they can, of course, drive you into even deeper abject poverty if you don't agree to the process in which they want to further enslave you.
Well, this is political season. The presidential 2016 presidential race is warming up a little bit. And we have people just saying, you know, I'm speaking now about the so-called liberals. I'm referring to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Both are saying, well, Puerto Rico ought to be able to declare bankruptcy, and we have to fix the law in Congress that this should happen. How genuine do you think this is, their public pronouncements? And considering that Puerto Rico has been a commonwealth of the U.S. for a long time, and these concerns did not come up before this dramatic $72 billion debt quagmire, is it that am I being paranoid or just cynical here by saying, well, it's an interesting thing that both Sanders and Clinton are taking an interest in Puerto Rico's constitutional rights, but precisely at a time that the issue is money and not the constitutional protections for the people of Puerto Rico?
I don't think you're being paranoid at all. I think it's quite interesting that this is entered into the 2016 presidential race, where the ostensible leading candidate, Hillary Clinton, is calling for changes to U.S. bankruptcy laws that, you know, would in fact grant Puerto Rico its public entities to restructure some of its supposed $72 billion in debt. And if Bernie Sanders is willing to go along with the same process without qualifications, then I think that speaks volumes as well. I think that also Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley has also weighed in on this, easing the bankruptcy laws also to allow Puerto Rico to sensibly restructure its debt. So I think it speaks a lot, you know, about the character of the candidates that are crowding the Democratic Party field at this time.
But they're speaking about the debt. They're speaking about Puerto Rico's access, as they call it, to federal bankruptcy laws that it could use to discharge its debt. They're not touching the question of the political connection between the United States and Puerto Rico.
No.
So I ask you, where is this? How is this going to show up in the discourse of how Puerto Rico discharges its debt?
Well, this is very important because it, you know, leaves this gray area in terms of public discourse about this issue, in terms of the political status of Puerto Rico, and which is never even really seriously addressed. You know, in essence, Puerto Rico, you know, is a colony of the United States, but they use the term Commonwealth. And but, you know, at the same time, people should ask themselves, well, why is the United States so concerned about how Puerto Rico deals with its own financial problems? And what is the role of the United States in that whole process? So these are the questions that people need to ask themselves. And this is not entering at all into the corporate media discussions about it. It's the whole discussion is centered around whether or not Puerto Rico should be allowed to file for bankruptcy in the United States courts. And so that is a discussion right now, even within the U.S. Congress itself, whether or not they're going to institute this new bill, new legislation that would, in effect, change the relations between Washington and Puerto Rico.
So in the same way that the debt question in Greece energized a response, grassroots activism and a serious challenge to the status quo by the people, could this do the same in Puerto Rico, basically bringing the question not so much of the debt, although, of course, it is about debt, but dealing with this overarching question, this unresolved question as to what the status of Puerto Rico should be. Is it a commonwealth? Is it independent? What is it? And what should it be? Is it going to spark that kind of discussion in Puerto Rico, you suspect?
It most definitely is, and I'm sure it's already going on because we do see a lot of discussion on websites and social media networks related to Puerto Rico about this issue. And I believe that this, coupled with other questions revolving around, for example, the release of Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera, and as well as the overall status of Puerto Rico in relationship to the United States, because if Puerto Rico was an independent state, they could form relations, equal relations, with other countries throughout the Caribbean and Latin America. ALBA, for example, and other alliances that have been formed over the last decade or so. So I think it should be a broader discussion because how could the United States, you know, being the dominant political and economic force in Puerto Rico, allow such a situation to develop? And irrespective of the popular will of the people in Puerto Rico to even discuss the passage of a bill that would facilitate the restructuring of Puerto Rico's relationship to the international financial institutions. So it definitely has to prompt a much broader and more politicized discussion.
Well, let's talk about Puerto Rico, because as we discuss this in the months to come, deciphering it the way we did with Detroit, we can't avoid the question of the role of Wall Street and the role of capitalists and the role of corporations in producing this onerous debt that Puerto Rico is now supposed to discharge by yielding valuable assets, by imposing draconian policies on austerity measures to recoup some kind of some lump sum of money to service the debt. What has been the historical nature, apart from the politics of the relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico, the relationship between U.S. mainland capital and Puerto Rico?
Yeah, there's been a long relationship in that regard. And it's quite interesting that this supposed $73 billion in debt, who is supposedly owed this money? And it's the same banks, the same financial institutions that you find located on Wall Street. And that's what's important, and that's what's not really discussed in this whole process. And the fact that you have countries like Puerto Rico, which are totally dominated by the United States, and then you have the individual states that have a different status under the control of Washington, at the same time being driven deeper and deeper in debt as well. So it's a quite an interesting scenario when you think about it. And if you read, for example, Bloomberg's and other financial publications, there's a lot of concern in these publications. They're treating this so-called debt crisis in Puerto Rico as something of a major concern to them. It's on the front page of these publications. So obviously the constituencies that they serve are very much worried about what's going on there, that Puerto Rico not be allowed to default, and that there is some restructuring process so all these major banks are able to be paid back what they claim Puerto Rico owes them. And it's quite interesting also in terms of how they've drawn this analogy between Puerto Rico and Detroit. Even USA Today and other publications have put out articles talking about the similarities between Detroit and Puerto Rico. So it's the same banks that are involved. It's the same process.
On another note, because this is going to come up, although it's implied, it's not really boldly stated, because I think people are being very careful about making analogies to race. But when you read these reports, part of what you get is the notion that Puerto Rico actually brought this on itself, and Puerto Rico is as a failed state in the same way that Detroit, particularly under African-American leadership, was a failed city. Are you getting any sense of that, that part of what is happening here and the reason that, and the way Puerto Rico's debt is being situated, that there's an underlying message that Puerto Rico is like, the stereotypical banana republic type thing, where people just can't, they don't have what it takes to be self-governing. They just can't, they just don't have what it takes to handle money. And so this is a problem, but it is also a problem that largely was self-inflicted.
Yes, and you hear the same thing in regard to Greece as well. Yes, it's blaming the victims for the economic crisis, when in fact it has been the corporations and international financial institutions that have driven Detroit, Puerto Rico, and Athens into the dire circumstances that they face at present. So the only solution that's proposed by Wall Street and by the European Union, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and others is for the aggrieved parties, these states, these municipalities, to pay the banks or whatever they claim is owed to them, and to cut pensions, to cut public spending, and to question the governing structures and whatever rights exist for these population groups that they cannot afford them, or that they're sometimes somehow not entitled to pensions, not entitled to public ownership of wealth. And that is the situation that's facing all of these states that have been impacted.
Well, the situation in Puerto Rico was described this way by Bloomberg on Bloomberg News on July the 1st. It said, Wall Street smoothed Puerto Rico's path to fiscal debacle. After the U.S. territory adopted a sales tax in 2006, investment banks worked with officials in San Juan to create new bonds backed by a portion of the tax. Banks, including your favorite, UBS, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs, reaped more than $900 million in fees to manage Puerto Rico's $126.6 billion of bond sales since 2000. These helped the government, which employs more than a quarter of the workforce, to put off cuts. The island's bond rating had fallen below investment grade in March 2014 as it issued $3.5 billion of general obligation bonds. The idea was to balance the budget, refinance debt, and buy time to revive a shrinking economy. But it paid dearly, as these junk-rated bonds had an 8.7% interest rate. Like U.S. states that can't file for bankruptcy, Puerto Rico's special tax status dates back to 1917 and the passage by the U.S. Congress of the Jones-Shafroth Act. Puerto Rico, ceded to the U.S. in 1898 after a war with Spain, has relied for 50 years on this and other tax breaks to drive its economic development. The incentives attracted pharmaceutical, textile, and electronics companies. The U.S. phased out the incentives from the mid-1990s to 2006, contributing to the loss of 80,000 jobs. Since 2006, Puerto Rico's economy has contracted every year except one, and its poverty rate is now almost double that of Mississippi, the poorest state. As jobs disappear, more Puerto Ricans are leaving. Population is heading toward a 100-year low by 2050. Now, what they're saying in this short overview is essentially that the economic engine of Puerto Rico is U.S.-based. And the economic engine and the political engine of Puerto Rico also is U.S.-based, since it must operate, or it has been operating, under these laws and these policies generated out of Congress and generated out of Wall Street. So Puerto Rico has been caught in between the two.
Yes, and that's why they've admitted that at least 53% of the U.S. municipal mutual fund market, they hold the positions in the Puerto Rican debt. So the U.S. has quite a lot at stake. And as you mentioned, they've attracted these investments through tax-free incentives, which have been backed up by the United States Congress. So, you know, this is the situation they have created. And when this method and this system fell into difficulty, 8, 9 years ago, then, of course, this is what we wind up with. So rather than these banks, the U.S. Congress, and the corporations that are exploiting the labor and the public interests of Puerto Rico by not paying taxes there, let them deal with this crisis rather than passing on to the people in Puerto Rico, as they've done here in the United States as well.
But in the meantime, the people who are now coming forward, people, again, like Clinton and Bernie Sanders and others who are now saying, oh, we are going to find a way, we have to find a way to give Puerto Rico access to some kind of a lever, an escape hatch, by way of tinkering with the laws to make it possible for them to file for bankruptcy. But they're not discussing these other arrangements. Is Congress going to continue running the political show, essentially, in Puerto Rico? Is Congress willing to accept any blame at all for this debacle that has cropped up in Puerto Rico, which was inevitable? It just is an unsustainable economic model. When you are operating as a colony, where corporations could do whatever they want and they have the protection of Congress, and of course with their donations to various campaigns and whatnot, they have access to tinker with the laws so that they operate in their favor. So when you could see how insincere, you know, how insufficient it is when these elected officials come forward now and say, yes, we are concerned about Puerto Rico, but only in terms of its debt and how we can help it discharge its debt.
Yes. No, they're not going to stop their involvement in Puerto Rico without, you know, anything short of a revolution. And because otherwise, why would they be attempting to pass yet another bill governing Washington's relationship with Puerto Rico? And it's also quite interesting, in parallel to Detroit, it's been reported in the corporate media in the United States that they have in Puerto Rico what they describe as a pension liability of $35 billion U.S. dollars. Now, this is the same scenario, not as large as they claim vis-a-vis the city of Detroit, and also the state of Illinois, the city of Chicago, and other municipalities throughout the United States, that they have underfunded pension systems. Many of these pension systems were invested in mutual funds, which were controlled by banks and bond agencies. So ultimately, their failures to invest properly, their lack of prudence in their own internal financing policies are a direct cause for the purported underfunding of the pension systems, and also the downsizing in the public sector as well, where not enough people are being hired, not enough people are paying into the pension systems. So consequently, this is the situation. And then what's so criminal about this, they frame it as a bailout, whether or not Puerto Rico is going to get a bailout, whether or not Greece is going to get a bailout. And that was an issue in Detroit as well. But it's really not a bailout. It's really a restructuring of the financial enslavement of all these areas to the international financial institutions.
Well, we have been given a pretty interesting parallel today, and it is unavoidable. I mean, we just can't see anything but a parallel here between the bankruptcy, the imposition of bankruptcy in Detroit, and this situation that has developed in Puerto Rico, where there's massive debt, and now comes the question of how are people going to get their money? Because that's the bottom line. Yes. And of course, you know, they're not discussing the objective conditions in Puerto Rico. We've seen massive outflow of people coming back to the mainland. This is going to be part of the discussion as well, because it might impact the various elections that will be held in 2016. And we see that in the end, there is no such thing as an isolated incident. These are all connected things, and we have to always understand that. This is the Detroit model was recently our wake-up call, but it was, as we insisted, that this was a template for what was going to happen in not only throughout the United States, where, of course, we've seen major cities with large populations of color being targeted, and in Michigan, almost every single community forced into emergency management had been one of a majority people of color. But here is Puerto Rico. And now if we have a groundswell of resistance here where people are able to situate come to terms with the reality and really situate this problem, it is quite possible that the ultimate goal would be not just the discharging of debt and the restructuring of debt and all of that, but it has to do essentially with sovereignty as a nation. What is Puerto Rico supposed to be? What does it want to do? What should it be? And the voices of the people guiding that entire discussion. So I want to thank you very much, Abayomi. So any last words as we close?
Yes, I think all these geopolitical regions are interconnected because of the world economic crisis. Today on Wall Street, they suspended trading. They claim it was a technological glitch that was behind it, but we see drops in the stock markets throughout the world, from China to other geopolitical regions. And I think that, the common denominator in all of this is clearly related to the fact of, as you mentioned, sovereignty, the right to self-determination and independence, whether it's in Ferguson, in Baltimore, in Detroit, in Athens, or in San Juan, or throughout the Puerto Rican territories. People have to reclaim their right to self-determination and the right to govern and conduct their own affairs. I think this is the only solution to all of this internationally.
Thank you so much, Abayomi, for being with us today and for bringing to our attention these important points that we should continue to consider. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Stay tuned. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what this program meant to you today. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining me. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.